So I believe that the clouds mean dreams and imagination. When we were kids, we liked to imagine shapes in the clouds and so on. And I believe that this is a moment where we have to breathe and also imagine the world of tomorrow with a certain lightness through daydreaming.
Seip also says he designs his creations to fit in with the environment using biodegradable paints made from natural pigments. The French artist is known for his massive graffiti works on grass that are best seen from the air. Some of his other works have adorned an impoverished shanty town in South Africa and the lawn in front of the UN headquarters in Geneva. One of Mexico's largest zoos has launched a one-of-a-kind exhibition with the star of the show being a manatee couple. Visitors will be able to see the couple at the new exhibition, which is part of the largest aquarium in the country. The zoo received the manatee couple from the Caribbean with the intention of raising awareness for the protection of the species. Part of the ticket proceeds will go towards conservation efforts. Manatees are fully aquatic, mostly herbivorous marine mammals that are sometimes known as sea cows. These funny-looking creatures are endangered because of pollution and fishing techniques.
Paleontologists in Egypt have discovered fossilized bones of an ancient whale that could probably walk on land and swim in water. Scientists found the skull, jaw and some ribs and identified the parts as the 43-million-year-old ancestor of the modern whale. It's also the earliest type of semi-aquatic whale found in Africa. The whale is estimated to have been 10 meters in length, weighing over half a ton, and was likely a top predator. Scientists say the four-legged whale is a key new species that helps trace the transition of whales from land to sea. Paleontologists believe that the ancestors of modern whales developed from deer-like mammals living on land over a 10-million-year period. The fossilized remains were discovered in Egypt's western desert, which was once covered by sea.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight.
In a new report authored by the National Priorities Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, it has been found that the federal government has spent $21 trillion on war and militarization both inside the U.S. and around the world over the past 20 years. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Lindsay Kashagarian Ryder. This article is published under the heading U.S. spent $21 trillion on war and militarization since 9/11. Stay tuned for more. Years have now passed since 9/11. The 20 years since those terrible attacks have been marked by endless wars, harsh immigration crackdowns, and expanded federal law enforcement powers that have cost Americans their privacy and targeted entire communities based on nothing more than race, religion, or ethnicity. Those policies have also come at a tremendous monetary cost and a dangerous neglect of domestic investment. In a new report authored by the National Priorities Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, it has been found that the federal government has spent $21 trillion on war and militarization both inside the U.S. and around the world over the past 20 years. That's roughly the size of the entire U.S. economy. Even while politicians have written blank checks for militarism year after year, they have said Americans can't afford to address the most urgent issues. No wonder these past 20 years have been rough on U.S. families and communities. After strong growth from 1970 to 2000, household incomes have stagnated for 20 years as Americans struggled through two recessions in the years leading up to the pandemic. As pandemic eviction moratoriums end, millions are at risk of homelessness. U.S. public health systems have also been chronically underfunded, leaving the U.S. helpless to enact the testing, tracing, and quarantining that help other countries limit the pandemic's damage. Over 650,000 Americans have died from COVID-19, the equivalent of 9/11 every day for over 7 months. The opioid epidemic claims another 50,000 lives a year. Meanwhile, extreme weather events like wildfires, hurricanes, and floods have grown in frequency over the past 20 years. The U.S. hasn't invested nearly enough in either renewable energy or climate resiliency to deal with the increasing effects climate change has on American communities. In the face of all this suffering, it's clear that $21 trillion in spending hasn't made Americans any safer. Instead, the human costs have been staggering. Around the world, the forever wars have cost 900,000 lives and left 38 million homeless. And as the disastrous withdrawal from Afghanistan has shown us, they were a massive failure. U.S. militarized spending has helped deport 5 million people over the past 20 years, often taking parents from their children. The majority of those deported hadn't committed any crime except for being in the U.S., and it has paid for the government to listen in on the phone calls and target communities for harassment and surveillance without any evidence of crime or wrongdoing, eroding the civil liberties of all Americans. There is a silver lining. It has been found that for just a fraction of what the United States has spent on militarization these last 20 years, they could start to make life much better. For $4.5 trillion, they could build a renewable upgraded energy grid for the whole country. For $2.3 trillion, they could create 5 million $15 an hour jobs with benefits for 10 years. For just $25 billion, they could vaccinate low-income countries against COVID-19, saving lives and stopping the march of new and more threatening virus variants. They could do all that and more for less than half of what they have spent on wars and militarization in the last 20 years. With communities across the U.S. in dire need of investment, The case for avoiding more pointless deadly wars couldn't be clearer. The subcontinent.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. The program aims to discuss the most significant issues in the subcontinent that affect the government, communities, organizations, and the region as a whole. And as usual, we will explore and explain its geopolitics, untangle the arguments from different perspectives, and make the alternative voices heard.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we are going to take a look at America's Afghanistan debacle 20 years after the cataclysmic events of 9/11 that found expression in the so-called global war on terror. And we shall discuss why the U.S. military-industrial complex decided to invade Afghanistan after the 9/11 attacks and what actually was on the agenda.
The military invasion of Afghanistan 20 years ago kick-started with the Pentagon carpet-bombing the landlocked country with B-52 heavy bombers and gunships. The disastrously misjudged response to the 9/11 attacks turned out to be nasty, brutish, and long. The so-called war on terror only bred more terrorism as successive regimes in Washington sought to conceal the truth. The futile military adventure that consumed millions of innocent lives finally ended with the way it started. Suicide bombings and drone strikes in the heart of Kabul.
Less than a month after four hijacked American planes crashed into landmark buildings in New York and Washington on September 11, 2001, killing 2,977 people, including 2,606 people at the Twin Towers and 125 at the Pentagon, then U.S. President led an invasion of Afghanistan, backed by an international coalition. The stated objective was to hunt down the alleged mastermind, the former CIA ally and Al-Qaeda founder Osama bin Laden, who was hosted by the Taliban. As the U.S. sent long-range B-52 Stratofortress strategic bombers, AC-130 Spectre gunships, and MQ-9 Reaper drones to bomb the Tora Bora cave complex in eastern Afghanistan, where bin Laden was reported to be hiding, Barbara Lee was the only U.S. congresswoman to vote against authorizing what was to turn into America's longest war in history.
September 11th changed the world. Our deepest fears now haunt us. Yet I am convinced that military action will not prevent further acts of international terrorism against the United States.
Barbara was labeled a traitor by those who championed the 20-year military adventure that incurred an astronomically high cost, with innocent Afghan civilians bearing the brunt. The so-called war on terror over the years only spawned more terrorism while failing to achieve any of its stated objectives. 20 years down the line, the Taliban are back in power, Al-Qaeda still exists, while the Americans have been forced to pack up and leave.
It's way past time for Americans to question all of these interventions. Of course, you know, our press goes absolutely apoplectic, you know, crazy at the thought of some foreign government possibly trying to have some kind of interference in our elections, and here we are literally going around the world laying waste to one country after another. And I think the consequences of these interventions tell the whole story, truly. You know, over the course of the last 20 years, there are at least 1 million people dead, and I think that's far below the actual figure. Tens of millions of people have been displaced from their home. This has created all of these waves of refugees in these crises around the world. In addition, we have thousands of Americans dead, and we've, again, spent all of these trillions, and that's just the money that we know of. I think that number also is probably quite low, but estimates have been $6 trillion. So we've been literally hemorrhaging resources and focus and money to these conflicts that have been disastrous one after another. And our own country is facing, you know, many serious issues, including a horrific deficit and debt. And we need to stop this hemorrhaging.
The Americans launched the invasion of Afghanistan on October 7, 2001, on the pretext of decimating the Taliban and Al-Qaeda and to capture the 9/11 mastermind Osama bin Laden. That was the stated objective. But the real agenda was more sinister, to militarily occupy the strategically located mineral-rich South Asian country. While the American public initially supported the idea of military action against the perpetrators of the 9/11 attacks, the support waned as the futile war dragged on, metamorphosing into a worst U.S. foreign policy disaster.
On the fateful afternoon of October 7, 2001, as the U.S. and allies started the three-week deadly bombing campaign in Afghanistan, dubbed the Operation Enduring Freedom, then U.S. President George Bush said the objective was to destroy Al-Qaeda, decimate the Taliban regime, and prevent the repeat of 9/11 attacks.
The Taliban regime is coming to an end.
The core objective was achieved in 3 months, but the Americans decided to continue the occupation. If eliminating Al-Qaeda and the Taliban or taking out Osama bin Laden were prime objectives of the military invasion, the U.S.-led Allied troops would have called it quits long ago. But the aim was to occupy Afghanistan, strategically located between Central and South Asia. It was clear from the way the Bush administration snubbed Taliban's offer of truce to prevent bloodletting. Before the bombing campaign began, the group offered to hand over bin Laden to a third country for trial and even agreed to lay down arms and recognize the US-backed government in Kabul, led by Hamid Karzai. The offers were spurned, leading to a misguided 20-year military adventure that ended in disaster.
This is in keeping with the policy of forever wars and never-ending wars. The purpose of the invasion of Afghanistan became, if it wasn't always the case, became a question of sustaining the various operations, the money-making operations that were going on there. So, you know, we see the same thing in Syria. I believe ISIS would have been completely defeated years ago, was it not for the U.S. illegal occupying troops there. So you don't want to get rid of the justification that you're using for the occupation that you're involved with. And, you know, this is how you keep wars going on for 20 years.
Even Americans woke up to the bitter reality years after rallying behind the war in Afghanistan. The worst U.S. military and strategic debacle not only failed to achieve its objectives, but laid bare America's global hegemonic project.
The key objective of invading Afghanistan immediately after the 9/11 attacks, as emphasized by Bush and his hawkish Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, was to, quote, find, stop, and defeat every terrorist group of global reach. The goal was practically unrealistic and unachievable. 20 years on, the threat of terrorism not only persists, but has assumed alarming proportions. Al-Qaeda is still around and thriving, while the Daesh militant group has mushroomed in Afghanistan under the shadow of U.S. forces. That's how America's ominous presence breeds terrorism rather than annihilating it.
In the aftermath of 9/11 attacks, Americans vowed to crush every terrorist group of global reach, including Al-Qaeda. Bush famously declared on September 20, 2001, that the U.S. war on terror begins with Al-Qaeda but does not end there. The impudence was clearly evident. Amidst the chaotic evacuation at Kabul's Hamid Karzai International Airport 2 weeks ago, a Daesh suicide bomber blew himself up, killing more than 200 people, including 13 U.S. Marines. The ghastly incident underscored not only the vulnerability of ordinary Afghans, but also the U.S. failure to eliminate the threat of terrorism in Afghanistan after a 20-year-long military campaign. It also blew the lid off U.S. military industrial complex's sinister interventionism in foreign lands. As reports later pointed out, the Kabul airport carnage also bore testimony to America's horrendous war crimes and impunity in Afghanistan. Many of those killed in the ensuing chaos at the airport didn't fall to the bombings, but to the indiscriminate firefight by American troops. More civilians perished later in the U.S. drone strikes. So as some would argue, 20 years after the doomed military mission began, Osama bin Laden has won the war posthumously. American presence in the war-ravaged country, often described as the graveyard of empires, not only failed to wipe out terrorism, but bred it.
Hundreds of thousands of deaths there, millions dislocated from their homes, an increase in radicalization and terrorism, horrific corruption, including making Afghanistan the number one exporter of illicit drugs in the world. All of these things, you know, we've so-called achieved there, and we've spent trillions of dollars doing it. So everything that's been achieved, in my opinion, has been quite negative to the point of, I would say, evil.
The war in Afghanistan, launched by George Bush in 2001, remained an enigma for his successors. After invading the country and destroying it beyond recognition, Bush launched another costly military adventure in neighboring Iraq in 2003. His successor, Barack Obama, refocused on Afghanistan, killing bin Laden 10 years after the 9/11 attacks. He began a drawdown but stopped short of a complete withdrawal. Years later, Donald Trump signed a withdrawal deal with the Taliban, and his successor, Joe Biden, finally pulled the plug on America's longest war.
The chronology of U.S. military invasion of Afghanistan following the 9/11 attacks sheds light on failed strategy and botched mission that plunged the war-ravaged country into chaos and turmoil. On September 11, 2001, a 19-member Al-Qaeda squad flew four U.S. airliners into the World Trade Center and Pentagon. A total of 2,977 people were killed. A week later, President Bush gave nod to military action. On October 7th, the bombing campaign began in Afghanistan under Operation Enduring Freedom. On April 17th, 2002, after the Taliban regime was ousted, a transitional government was formed in Kabul. Between 2003 and 2008, Taliban regrouped even as the U.S. troop presence surged. In December 2009, Barack Obama raised the strength of U.S. forces to 100,000. On May 2, 2011, 9/11 mastermind Osama bin Laden was killed by U.S. forces in Pakistan, not in Afghanistan. A month later, Obama announced gradual withdrawal of troops from Afghanistan. In 2014, the U.S.-NATO combat operations came to an end, although it never ended. The period between 2014 and 2019 was marked by uncertainty. On January 28, 2019, the U.S. and Taliban agreed on a framework for U.S. withdrawal. On February 29, 2020, the two sides reached a final deal. On January 15, 2021, U.S. troops in Afghanistan dropped to 2,500. On August 6, 2021, Taliban launched an offensive, laying siege to Kabul a week later. On August 30, 2021, the last remaining U.S. troops left Afghanistan.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. John Kirvikau, journalist and former CIA counterterrorism officer. Before we begin, so glad to have you back on the program, Mr. Kirvikau. Sir, the failed mission in Afghanistan caps off 20 years of refusing to acknowledge the limits of American power. Could you say the response to the 9/11 attacks was poorly planned and incompletely executed?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me. I think that that the initial response, the initial U.S. Military response in Afghanistan was not poorly planned or incompletely executed. When you recall that the initial response was just to destroy al-Qaeda. We went into Afghanistan in October of 2001, and by December of 2001, al-Qaeda was destroyed. We should have declared victory at that point, and we should have come home. Instead, we didn't. We made a terrible miscalculation, a terrible mistake in December of 2001 to remain in Afghanistan and to try to build the country into some sort of Western-style democracy. The Afghans did not ask us to do that. The American people had no idea that that's what the government intended to do. And instead, what it did is it practically bankrupted us as a country. It resulted in the loss of hundreds of thousands of lives, including thousands of Americans, and it was a terrible policy mistake.
Sir, do you think the whole misguided post-9/11 global war on terrorism, which found expression in futile military adventures in Afghanistan and Iraq, was an emotional overreaction?
I actually do think that the response in Afghanistan and Iraq was an emotional miscalculation. And on the one hand, I can actually understand and I think explain why we miscalculated in Afghanistan. Iraq is a little worse, but in Afghanistan, you know, this was such a major national trauma for us. The 9/11 attacks saw the deaths of 3,000 Americans, and so upwards of 95% of Americans wanted to attack Afghanistan, to kill Osama bin Laden, and to make the Taliban pay for their support for bin Laden and al-Qaeda. Iraq was a different story, though. Iraq was a deliberate effort by the neoconservatives who were in charge and power in the White House to just make war on a country whose politics we didn't like. When a country is invading another, when a country is occupying another, it doesn't matter who the head of that country is, its citizens are going to protect themselves and their families and their property. And that was something that neoconservatives at the White House didn't understand. They didn't fully appreciate. And as a result, we were bogged down in two wars that nearly bankrupted us over the course of 20 years.
Now let's take a break from the questions and take a look at how the global media has covered the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks in the backdrop of America's disastrous war and botched exit from Afghanistan.
What started as an operation to eradicate al-Qaeda has ended two decades later with the return of its Afghan enablers to power. Rarely have so many lives and so much cash been spent on so little. It would be nice to think that US politics will learn from this debacle and both parties are complicit, but the story is far from over. America may have quit this forever war, but it will go on. There will be little time for postmortems as we come to grips with the implications of a rebooted Taliban. In his long war against America, Osama bin Laden has won a sweeping, if posthumous, victory. The US reaction to the 9/11 attack he masterminded is like the cytokine storm that can occur when COVID-19 attacks us. The defensive measures our bodies mount go too far and damage the vital organs our antibodies were meant to protect. The 9/11 era began in Afghanistan, and now it has ended there in humiliating defeat.
Now, the American public initially rallied behind the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, but the support waned over time. Today, a vast majority of Americans have become critical of the U.S. foreign policy. So, what reasons would you attribute to it?
The issue is that literally nobody in the country thought that 20 years later we would still be involved in these countries. And so, over time, the vast majority of Americans began to oppose both wars, both Afghanistan and Iraq, to the point where now there's been something of a sea change in American politics, where people are far more isolationists now. We saw that with Donald Trump's presidency. People don't want to be involved in these entanglements overseas. And another problem is that, you know, we've made a lot of people very rich with our military budgets over the last 20 years. We spend more on the military in the United States than the next 8 largest countries combined. If you're an American who's struggling to pay the electric bill or the gas bill or to put food on the table or to put your children through school. And finally, after 20 years, people had enough.
So up to now, we've seen Taliban's stunning takeover, US's hasty withdrawal, the collapse of the Afghan government, and the new Afghan refugee crisis. So could you tell us, what does this tell about the American military interventions?
Yeah, the collapse of the Afghan government points to an intelligence failure, an analytic failure. President Biden said that the Afghan government could survive for 6 months. In fact, it survived for 6 days. He didn't make up that date. He was given that date by the CIA. The CIA got it wrong again. And I think the bottom line is that everything leading to the end of the U.S. presence in Afghanistan was a disaster. Now we have a hostile government in Kabul led by people who happen to be on the FBI's most wanted list, which is kind of funny and ironic. You've got a refugee crisis. You have American citizens who are stuck in Afghanistan and can't get out. What this tells us, I think, about American military interventions, and I apologize if I'm repeating myself, is that we never have a viable exit strategy. We don't know when the job is done, and we don't know when to declare victory and just go home. And we should have gone home 20 years ago.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Kiriakou for his precious time and insight. And as always, love to have you again on the program. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media and cyberspace on 20 years since the 9/11 attacks and the Afghanistan debacle.
British journalist and broadcaster Piers Morgan says Biden's shameful Afghanistan disaster has made America look weak, spineless, and cowardly 20 years after the 9/11 attacks. George Papadopoulos, an American author and former Trump advisor, notes that Afghanistan will be run by the same group that was uprooted after 9/11, calling it intentional by Biden to humiliate the U.S. military. Afghan-American community organizer Halima Wali slams the U.S. for tearing apart Afghanistan and blaming it for 9/11 when Osama bin Laden was found in Pakistan and the 9/11 hijackers were Saudi nationals. Arjun Sethi, a US-based lawyer and activist, says nothing will change the fact that Americans should never have invaded Afghanistan, stayed so long, withdrawn recklessly, and indulged in worse human rights abuses. American political scientist David Rothkopf argues that the response to 9/11 attacks was hijacked by opportunists with personal agendas that were ideological or industry-driven.
And that was our episode about America's misguided response to the 9/11 attacks and its humiliating defeat in Afghanistan after the 20-year-long disastrous military adventure. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take care.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Activists on the ground fear public concern for the disaster-struck region in Louisiana is already waning, leaving people in a state hit hard by the COVID pandemic vulnerable to widespread hunger and houselessness. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Mike Ludwig, journalist. This article is published under the heading, "It's Not Just a Loss of Electricity. Ida left people houseless and jobless." Stay tuned for more. In Louisiana, residents and advocates were already bracing for a wave of hardship and home evictions across an economically vulnerable region when Hurricane Ida slammed into southeastern Louisiana recently, destroying homes and businesses and displacing tens of thousands of people during a COVID surge. The storm left entire communities without power and clean water for over a week and countless workers without a paycheck as rents came due and federal pandemic supports dissipated. For Louisianans in Hurricane Ida's path, the last-minute decision to evacuate their homes or shelter in place for the deadly storm was only the beginning. After the storm passed, came days of sweltering heat without power, the scramble to put tarps on leaking roofs, days of waiting for the phone and internet service needed to apply for federal disaster relief that many still have not received. For those who evacuated, the cost of living on the road piled up alongside the anxiety of deciding when to return to disrupted lives and damaged homes. Activists on the ground fear public concern for the disaster-struck region is already waning, leaving people in a state hit hard by the COVID pandemic vulnerable to widespread hunger and houselessness. National attention quickly moved to the East Coast as Ida dumped heavy rains and caused widespread flooding in New York and New Jersey that left dozens of people dead. In the lower-lying and coastal parishes that took the brunt of the storm, the recovery could take years, according to August Crepo, principal chief of the United Huma Nation. At least 11,000 of the Huma tribe's 19,000 members living across the five parishes hit hardest by the storm have been affected. Crepel, a firefighter who worked day and night over the past 2 weeks providing disaster relief, said the United Huma Nation has spent decades fighting for federal tribal recognition and the enhanced support and disaster relief that comes with it. Back in New Orleans, organizers fear a wave of evictions will erupt after an order from the state's Democratic governor pausing legal proceeding expires on September 24th, further displacing people who survived the storm or attempt to return after evacuating. Many people in the Crescent City and across southeast Louisiana work low-wage jobs in the service, tourism, and retail industries and could be without work or a paycheck for weeks. Louisiana cut off pandemic unemployment benefits in late July, and the Supreme Court struck down an already weak federal moratorium on evictions just days before the storm. Less than 14% of the $248 million in federal emergency assistance for home renters in Louisiana has been distributed so far, compared to 67% in Texas and 100% in New York, according to the National Low Income Housing Coalition. Recently, the New Orleans Renters' Rights Assembly released a list of demands calling on the city to keep its eviction court closed until all the federal rental assistance is distributed and at least until the end of the year. The tenants' union said an additional $500 million in rental assistance is needed across the state. Last summer, protesters blocked and shut down the city's eviction court after local and state moratoriums on evictions expired, an action that made national headlines and put pressure on federal policymakers to implement a national eviction moratorium. Activists say the rental assistance program, which is administered by the state in rural areas and by city officials in New Orleans, is in need of an overhaul. Instead of requiring renters to produce onerous amounts of documentation and making relief payments to landlords, housing justice activists in New Orleans and beyond say people who fell behind on rent during pandemic lockdowns should receive assistance in cash, a model that has already proven successful in other communities. The tenants' union say the city must also provide a dedicated multilingual staff to help people with disabilities apply for rental assistance and disaster relief. The tenants' union is also demanding the right to return for all residents displaced by the storm, including renters who live in damaged homes. Even if legal evictions are temporarily halted, organizers fear the landlords will neglect badly needed repairs, forcing people to either live in uninhabitable homes or go someplace else. Louisiana has few legal protections for renters who can receive an eviction notice after withholding rent for any reason, even if that reason is a giant hole in the roof. At least 350 oil spills were reported in southeast Louisiana and the Gulf of Mexico after Ida, according to reports. The days spent without electricity in the hot sun prompted more urgent calls for solar energy, an obvious solution for maintaining power for residents during a natural disaster. If more homes and businesses had solar panels connected to community microgrids and power banks, thousands of people could have kept refrigerators and air conditioners running, which can save lives during heat waves and other climate disasters. New Orleans residents are still clearing debris and repairing damaged homes after most of the city spent over a week without power. Many households emptied their refrigerators during the power outage, and the smell of garbage hangs in the summer air. Economic divide.
The fall of the U.S. dollar is happening, 1 cent at a time. While there's a decline in the U.S. standing as a superpower, there's also the harsh reality that the U.S. is facing, the decline of the U.S. dollar. Hi, I'm Kabat Ahlai. In this edition of Economic Divide, we will look at whether the fall of the U.S. dollar is hyped or whether it is really happening, like a slow death for the U.S. Coming up in today's program, the share of the U.S. dollar in reserves held by central banks has fallen to its lowest level. What does that mean? Is that a move away from the dollar? That is a key question that we'll be looking at in this program. Another one of the highlights is how U.S. debt is playing a role in the decline of the dollar. There's a sovereign debt crisis that the U.S. is experiencing. Is that a reason for the dollar to collapse? We will examine the ways that that may be happening. And finally, we will take a look at something that the U.S. is using called dollar weaponization. The key instrument, sanctions, and the countries that are at the receiving end of it, at least some of them, are Iran, Russia, and China. Stay tuned. The dollar is king. That is the saying.
Well, the dollar is very strong. The country is very strong. The dollar is it's a beautiful thing in one way, but it makes it harder to compete. And despite that, but we have a very powerful dollar.
But it has been losing its value for quite some time. This new worry, COVID-19. Investors are worried the U.S. response is dealing a blow to the dollar, its status as the world's reserve currency declining.
With the recent gold price rally, and fueled by the ongoing and growing socioeconomic issues, the USD's position as the world's reserve currency might be threatened.
Investors and analysts, including billionaire hedge fund manager Ray Dalio and Goldman Sachs Group strategist, are warning that massive U.S. government spending in recent months could hurt the U.S. dollar. At the same time, rock-bottom U.S. interest rates for the foreseeable future and concerns over a potential rise in inflation are denting the dollar's appeal.
What we've seen this go around is the need to distribute, to produce a lot of debt. Where did those checks come from? They came from the government. The government wrote the checks. But the government can't produce money. The central bank can produce money.
These factors are already weighing in on the dollar, which stands 9% below its high of the year and had its worst monthly performance in a decade for the month of July.
When there has to be a lot of selling of bonds, and bonds don't give any good return, there's a guaranteed negative return in bonds relative to inflation. And there's a pile of people who own bonds. And this isn't just Americans, but these are international investors owning bonds. And they have to buy a lot more bonds, because when the government has to sell a lot more debt, that means they have to buy a lot more bonds, there will not be enough demand for those bonds.
There's also the real issue about the economic policies of major governments of the world. The declining value of the U.S. dollar has come about because the investment community sees the U.S. government following a more expansive economic program than the other major governments.
It's a critical market. Let's face it, China's the world's second largest economy. It's one of the fastest growing major economies today. We've all seen some of the economic challenges of the world over the last 2 years with COVID and some of the struggles to recover from that. China was kind of first in and first out, and so has done recovered very quickly.
The U.S. dollar has been declining in value for quite some time. The key question is why? Also, we keep hearing about the fall of the dollar as the top currency of choice, but actual numbers prove otherwise. First, the fall. That is true. Since March 2020, its decline has moved steadily after the U.S. presidential elections. In the middle of July, July 15 to be exact, the WSJ dollar index was 90.57. Just before the election that happened on November 3, the index stood at 88.25. Then the decline in the value of the U.S. dollar picked up steam. Why did the U.S. start losing its value due to Biden's election win? Well, because the U.S. President Biden at this point has taken a more aggressive stance with respect to the economy. Just take a look at this $6 trillion budget plan. Now, this was proposed in May, which did not get fully approved. Included the following: a $1.5 trillion request for operating expenditures for the Pentagon and other government departments. It also incorporated two plans that he had previously publicized: a $2.3 trillion jobs plan and a $1.8 trillion family plan. That's quite a lot, isn't it? And we're also going to cover how that affects the standing of the dollar. Well, joining us in the studio is our guest, Ahmad Salehi. Welcome. It's a pleasure to have you with us. He is an economic analyst, and he has a specialty in the management of industrial projects. And this is his Twitter address, @AhmadSalehi _MEY May. And also, he is active on Instagram. Ahmad.Salehi _official is his address on Instagram. So welcome. Obviously, our topic is the dollar, and my key question here is a general one. Why the U.S. dollar is used as a reserve currency? It's most often used in trade, given the fact that there are other currencies, and it still is the reserve currency of choice. I mean, the whole international financial system seems to be structured around the U.S. dollar. What's the reason? I mean, does the U.S. have a monopoly over it?
My pleasure to be here.
Sure.
Actually, the whole thing is a matter of trust and a plain check that the world gave the United States in Bretton Woods. What was the underlying foundation that gave the United States this power was the old cold myth that wars are good for the economy of the United States. You have to carefully study the history of the First and Second World War. Actually, when the world was in a war during both the world wars, the United States was providing the world with goods and material, but it was not getting currency but gold in compensation. So during these two world wars, 2/3 of the gold reserves of the central banks was accumulated in Federal Reserve. So this was the first common foundation that gave the authority of the United States in Bretton Woods to actually dominate its dollar.
Okay, let's fast forward then. Thank you for that history check on that. Hopefully that answers a lot of questions regarding the dollar back then and its beginning. But we're going to take a look at two different vantage points in the way that the dollar is being covered. First, we're going to take a look at this graph. It says the IMF's new data shows that the share of the U.S. dollar reserves held by central banks fell to 59%. That is the lowest level in 25 years. And that happened during the fourth quarter of 2020. Mm-hmm. So it's very recent, pretty recent, actually. So that's one way that the dollar is being covered. Then you have this following clip and its take on how the dollar is doing right now.
Even as the coronavirus pandemic wreaked havoc across global markets, wiping out trillions of dollars worth of assets, the U.S. dollar was unaffected by the turmoil. At one point, it soared 4% against a basket of major currencies, namely the euro, pound, yen, Canadian dollar, Swiss franc, and Swedish krona.
So on the one hand, you have that in terms of the reserves falling to its lowest level in 25 years, and then you have what it said here, that during the pandemic, the dollar actually rose, and it actually gained strength against the other currencies in the basket. Yes.
Actually, we have to take a look at it from a wider span. There are reasons that the empire of dollar is dominant in the world. We can simplify it into four pillars. The first pillar is the trade of the energy, mainly oil in the world, which is purely done by dollar. The second pillar is the IMF and the World Bank as the regulators of the fiscal and monetary policies throughout the world. And the third pillar is the WTO, which is the main function of WTO is spreading and increasing and promoting the global trade. And we know that the global trade is done via dollar. And the last, actually, pillar is the reserves, the currency reserves of the central banks. So if you want to have a better look at what is going on and what will be the future, we have to study carefully these four pillars. Of course, there are some internal factors also inside the United States economy. We're talking about the socio-economical parameters like the demographic of the population, the age of the population, which is getting older and older. But regardless of the internal factors of United States economy, when we look at these four pillars, we see that all of them are changing, not with a very rapid speed, but with this steady one.
We're going to have you back a little later on in the program, but for now, thank you very much for that, Ahmed Saleh. We do appreciate your comments, obviously very insightful there. So you heard some of the explanation that was given there by Ahmed Saleh. Our next piece is going to take a look at the U.S. dollar, but in terms of the debt that it has accumulated, how that plays into the picture. And obviously with that comes the printing of the greenback, as you're about to find out.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
It's time now for our in-depth section. We are going to take a look at the U.S. dollar and why it's called a petrodollar. You may have heard the term, and how that is actually under threat. Now, the petrodollar, by definition, is any U.S. dollar that's paid to oil-exporting countries in exchange for oil. The dollar, as you know, is the preeminent global currency. That's how it's been. As a result, most international transactions, including oil, are priced in petrodollars. Now, oil-exporting nations actually receive dollars for their exports, but not in their own currency. Now, the question comes about in terms of how oil is pegged to the dollar and not to another currency. I mean, that's a viable question.